Well, here we are, friends, 4 years later. Does it feel like yesterday or a lifetime ago? Both, maybe, for some of you. Hey, I know what it takes to get out the door at this time of day from children. So if you're in that boat, thank you so much for being here. I know many of you don't have a lot of free time, so I don't take it lightly that you're spending it here listening to me. The last time I spoke at Story Night, it was August of 2018. So say hi to yourselves. There you are up on the screen, a picture of several of you that are here again in the front row tonight. That morning that this picture was taken, our middle guy, Owen, started in his TK class here at Trinity Preschool. And so it was a big, exciting day for our family. To ground you all a little bit, at that time, our church was in the early weeks of a painful pastoral transition where we had more questions than answers. And then 7 weeks after that, our sweet son Owen received a really hard diagnosis. And since that time, our family did cancer again, and we all watched our church grow and change. And we've watched our world grow and change during a global pandemic. My husband Jonathan and I needed to make a joke that if you go through cancer again as a family, you get to speak at Story Night again. So, whoop whoop, there's my joke. Thank you, Jonathan. But really being up here on this stage feels like it's both way too soon and also 800 years ago. And I want to start by saying that I feel very honored and very humbled and also very terrified in sharing pieces of my story tonight. And I think that's because I'm so aware that this story and this moment is just a moment. I'm not planning to give you a story with a tidy ending. I'm here to tell a story that is living, breathing, and still being written. So where did we last leave off? Well, I told you about my childhood and how I came to know Jesus and what my faith meant to me when my husband went through cancer treatment. And I also gave you small glimpses of my life at the present time too. But some things I kept to myself. God was doing a work in my heart that close friends knew about but felt tender to process with a huge audience. In fact, when I first got asked to speak in 2018, I said no, because I was saying no to everything in 2018, which I'll get to that in a second. But it felt like my life was under construction, and I was fine to tell people so, but I wasn't ready to walk everyone through each room being remodeled. Telling a finished story, the grand remodel reveal, ends with a sigh of relief. But telling an in-process story comes with vulnerability. And one of the biggest things I've realized in the last 5 years is that we are always in process. And so we never get to say, ta-da, I'm perfect. I've got it together now. I'm fit to tell my story. In 2016 and 2017, I was juggling a lot. We had a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a baby, and we were living in a little condo by UCSB. And it was the second place we'd rented since moving back to Santa Barbara. The first house, a darling but very poorly insulated home in San Roque, had let us rent for a year before cutting our lease early to sell. And I'm sure many of you in this room know the feeling, because Santa Barbara real estate is Santa Barbara real estate, and that means it's really hard out there. In fact, there was an article in the Washington Post just this week talking about Los Angeles real estate prices that says an average family would have to set aside 85% of their annual income to own a home. It's crazy out here, right? So when you get kicked out of a rental, especially when your kids are school age, it's a little panic-inducing. And after it happened the first time, we became even more determined to buy a home, but it felt impossible. I was working part-time hosting a startup podcast that paid very little money but took a lot of time. I'd considered going back to work in marketing, but as we all well know, childcare is expensive too, and then I'd be away from my kids all day while still hardly saving much in the process. I'm telling you all things as women that you know and experience, but at the same time, do we talk about this enough? Do we really talk about the demands on families in this town who are trying to pull off the impossible? I wanted it all. To do what I loved and to raise my children and to own a home, and I was willing to drive myself ragged to make it happen. So we invested in a small business owning healthy vending machines, and some of you remember this season for me because it involved wearing a baby while filling up inventory in the machines while also podcasting in the evenings and chasing children around during the day. It was incredibly exhausting. And to be honest, I started to crack a little bit. I was anxious, panicky, teary-eyed, and felt like a failure all the time. I remember calling a counselor for help. And when I explained the scenario to her, she paused thoughtfully. And she said, "It looks like you have a lot of things you value, Leslie, and they are all important and good things. But you're holding them like this, and I wonder what it would look like to hold them like this." She wanted me to recognize that I was holding all my values the same, and they needed to be prioritized from top to bottom. And when she asked this question, a light bulb of understanding went on. I said, "Thank you so much." And I left. And then I said, "Nope, I cannot prioritize these values. I cannot let go of a single one. They are all very important to me and I will hold them all equal." At some point, I started believing a lie that I needed to have it all and be it all and that I could have it all if I worked hard enough. And what I didn't realize until much later is that I also wanted to be someone extraordinary. So for another 6 months, I kept the values like this, but in the meantime, my stress level went like this, higher and higher and higher. One of the things that bothered me most was that as I tried to prioritize my values or let some go, it didn't feel like God had anything to say about it. In fact, it didn't feel like God was present or active in my life anymore and that he hadn't been for a while. It wasn't that I doubted his existence, although that's very normal for many people, but that I doubted his activity in me. He felt removed and disinterested, like he didn't care what choices I made or didn't want to give me any direction. I was alone and he was silent. And I remember thinking, I don't know if I've ever really heard his voice in my life. Have I? Do I just not remember? I read my Bible, I did home group studies, I journaled, but it was just kind of all meh. So on October 14th, 2017, I knew something needed to change and I took myself for a retreat day in town. And I started at the Labyrinth over at UCSB. And a little side note is that some of you might remember that I talked a lot about the Labyrinth in my last story night. And this retreat day was the first time I'd ever walked one. I'd never done anything like this before, the Labyrinth or the retreat day, but I decided I wanted an entire day to think and to pray. There was a book about Moses that I'd been reading and an Enneagram personality test that Anna Jordan had made me take that felt really convicting, and I decided I just needed quiet and silence because I never got it at home. So the Enneagram was a new thing for me at the time, and it's become somewhat of a cliche buzzword these days, and people either love it or hate it, so hang with me here for a second. When people dislike the Enneagram, it's for one of two reasons. Some people say it's a senseless navel-gazing exercise that puts too much focus on the self. But others will say they hate it because it calls out all the worst parts of a person's personality. And really, that's no fun to see all your worst parts, right? And that's what happened for me. The Enneagram's gift is helping a person to see their false self. The regular patterns of unhealthy or even cruel behaviors we consciously and unconsciously go back to as we move through the world. John Calvin said, "There's no deep knowing of God without a deep knowing of self, and no deep knowing of self without a deep knowing of God." Though I consciously know I'm a person who isn't perfect, I had not until this time been able to see it the way the Enneagram called it out for me. And it was through this test that I began understanding myself better and then began a new gravitation toward the Holy Spirit. Because knowing myself better and knowing God better went hand in hand. And one of the points of the Enneagram is to call out the junk so we can change. And we have a Holy Spirit who can help us change to be more like Jesus. And I really, really wanted to be a person who was less anxious and less jealous and less resentful and less angry. And so I took this retreat day and wandered around on Santa Barbara beaches and read scripture and looked back on my journal from that spring. And I noticed a pattern in what I'd written over and over again in my journal. Be still. It was in verses I'd marked. It was in prayers of longing for rest. It was in quotes from books I was reading and podcasts I was listening to. And at first I thought be still meant to find quiet or to let go of so much of the activities that kept me distracted from God's voice. And it is this, yes, but if you look at what be still means, it actually translates as cease your striving. Cease your striving. Those three words were a bit of a gut punch when someone is striving all the time. But I realized that in a variety of different avenues, through the unsettled feeling I'd been carrying for so long, through the Bible, through my counselor, through a few worship songs I loved, that God had been speaking very clearly and I just hadn't heard him because I'd filled my life to such a busy and noisy place. My life was so loud and my soul was so loud. A friend of mine, Liz Diddy, says learning to listen is about noticing all the things God is already saying that we may not be hearing. And for me, that's been very true over the last 4 years since I started paying attention. I came home that night of the retreat and I told Jonathan I was quitting everything, and I mostly meant it. Over the next months, I let a lot go. We sold the vending machines and lost some money. I let go of a podcast I'd been working really hard to build that was becoming quite successful. And this also meant not knowing how we'd buy the house we'd longed for. By the start of 2018, I'd even paused all my social media accounts with the goal of spending 6 months off of them. But right at the beginning of the new year, as I'd said no to so much, it turns out I had to say yes to some hard things too. There was something going on in my family of origin that was very complicated and painful. And for the sake of my family, I won't go into details of it, but I had longed for a better relationship with a few family members. And sometimes to get to healing, you have to first dig up a lot of dirt. In the process, I started discovering that there were a lot of things I believed about myself that I'd learned in childhood that weren't true. And I'm telling you this because I believe all of us learn ways of being from our families, even the healthiest of families. And often it impacts how we view God and how we think God feels about us. I think they say counseling can be like peeling layers of an onion. I think that's the right saying. And despite having a childhood that was really so lovely in so many ways, there have been some layers that have had to be peeled. For example, one of those layers is that I didn't feel the ability to develop my own voice and opinions when I was young. There were a lot of rights and wrongs, and then I added my own right and wrongs to the mix. And so now when I get invited to do things like story night, the voice I have to battle nonstop says things like, you just want attention and no one wants to hear from you again. And at the same time, this was really, really hard work. And it's not work that is finished and maybe never fully will be. But now I can look back and see that the family healing was one of many ways God wanted to offer me wholeness. So if you're still tracking with me, I quit all the things, started 2018 with a lot of no's, a big yes to family of origin healing, and then there was the great housing shakeup that February. I mentioned that some of the wrestling for us was related to wanting a permanent home, and I recognize this is a sensitive topic because I'm speaking to a church that's quite affluent, and yet I know many, many people who work very hard and have great jobs and cannot afford the cost of living here. It's an odd feeling to feel financially strapped when most of us are, by worldly standards, not poor. Because we felt so stressed about housing, it was something I prayed about frequently, mostly when I was driving around town. And as I drove, I'd say this to God, God, do you want us to rent forever? Because we would like to buy. Would you show us where you want us to live? You know who you want our neighbors to be, who you want us to minister to, and where our kids will thrive. I know what I want, but I don't know what you want. So show me what you want. And you guys, I'll tell you what I wanted. I wanted to live in a single family home with a remodeled kitchen and a highly ranked public school with a very nice backyard for entertaining. And my list had a lot more things than this, but I will spare you the details. But we had moved a lot by then, and I noticed that God always had a slightly different vision than I did. So my prayers were not begging prayers. They started to become submissive prayers. In February of 2018, our landlords told us they were selling our house, just like what had happened a few years earlier. We at the time had a great deal on rent, and everything else in the area had gone up, and we panicked. They thankfully gave us 5 months' notice, which is kind of unheard of. So we began considering all the options until one day we passed some new condos being built by the airport, and Jonathan said, yes. And I will admit, I said, nope, because I wanted the darling home close to friends' houses, not a condo in Old Town Goleta, and not an average school. The price was still more than we could afford to get into, so I had no excuse really to be picky. With a tax break, we could swing the monthly payments, but to get in felt impossible. So we got in on an equity share program that existed at the time, and we asked a family member for a small loan. And I'm so thankful that we had someone who could say yes to that ask. And also, I had to wrestle with why I felt embarrassed to ask. I wanted to do it all on our own, and I didn't want to need help. And all of these decisions required a reordering of my values, which was something I'd been so unwilling to do earlier. So why am I telling you this story? Well, because we don't talk about these things enough, because money stuff is weird and awkward and we're not supposed to talk about it, right? But here's all I know, and really all that matters is that I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be, because the provision of this condo came right in the middle of a season where I let go of all my striving and simply waited. And it came in a season of listening. It came right as I last spoke at story night. And it came just 2 months before our middle son got cancer at 5 years old. And this house has been a sanctuary for us during that year of his sickness and 2 years of pandemic living. And that burning in my heart to pray for a place of permanency for our family was given to me by God, because he knew what was coming next for me, and he provided for it in a least expected way. And I'm not sure there's a girl more grateful for her condo anywhere in Goleta. Richard Rohr is a Catholic writer, and he said this: if you don't practice dying ahead of time, it comes as a shock when you get a terrible diagnosis. Why, this shouldn't happen to me. We move into a sense of entitlement that really doesn't serve us well. People who practice letting go, they're the happy ones. Life doesn't disappoint them. How, he asks, do we unclench our hands and let go? And he says it starts in the little things. And the year leading up to Owen's diagnosis was a practice in letting go of little and big things. So I last left you in the middle of all this wrestling, the first year of a new pursuit to know God's love and leading in my life. That same month that I spoke, Owen had his annual pediatrician appointment where his stomach was touched and felt and all was good in his small little body. In September, after story night, he began experiencing some occasional stomach aches, but we didn't think much of it because somebody at my house always has a stomach ache. But in October, his stomach ache became so hard that over the course of a few days, he began walking funny. But he wanted to keep going to soccer practice in school, so we figured he was just being a little dramatic. It wasn't until his preschool teacher said something to me that I decided I should get another opinion. When we touched his stomach, it was huge and hard on just the right side, and it looked funny to me. On Monday morning, October 15th, almost exactly 1 year to the day of the retreat where I quit all the things, I took him to his pediatrician, who immediately sent us for an ultrasound. I knew from the look on her face that something was wrong, and I began to panic. I'm sure there are some of you in this room who have experienced traumatic moments in your life when specific sights and smells become seared into your memory. And this is what I remember from that day. I remember Jonathan calling me to say the pediatrician wanted to see us in person with results. I remember calling Greta Brunel and asking her to pick Anna up from school. I remember stopping for gas at the mobile station on Mission Street and calling my mom. I remember the exact parking spot I chose at Children's Medical Clinic, and I think of it every time I pull back in there. I remember Dr. Irby saying Wilms tumor while Owen played with a Happy Meal toy. I remember her saying kidney and usually treatable while thinking about another little girl in this town who it wasn't treatable for. I remember telling myself I could cry after the kids went to bed, but failing. And I remember lying to Owen because I didn't yet know what to tell him. I remember thinking to myself, if this child dies, I don't know if I'll be able to believe in God anymore. Going through cancer with a child as opposed to an adult, like when Jonathan went through it, was harder for us. Even though we weren't the patient, a parent gets on that bed as if they are, in body and soul. With a child, we found ourselves angrier and more confused than we felt with Jonathan's diagnosis. I think some of you in this room felt that with us or have felt it with your own children. Cancer is never fair or easy, but this child was so innocent. He hadn't yet ever suffered in his life. And even if he survived, his diagnosis felt like a loss of innocence. We mourned for the present and for the unknown future. And it impacted his siblings too, because they were too young to have to explain what cancer is. We also had a lot of questions and guilt. Owen was conceived as a bit of a surprise only a few months after Jonathan finished his own chemotherapy, and I wondered if there was a link and if we'd done something to cause it, and why us again. We were processing our own terror and grief while also having to contemplate what it looked like to parent our children well in that moment. How much do you tell them? What do you hide? What might we regret hiding later? When you're facing a life-threatening diagnosis, the goal at the end is life. And when that's the goal, you have to not only make a plan of attack to survive, but to help this child thrive emotionally in a medical setting where he was terrified. By the next morning, we were at the pediatric oncologist who made appointments for more testing of every kind you can imagine. Because his tumor was large, he was at risk of having it rupture. And so we had to be careful with him, and things needed to move pretty quickly. For many kids with Wilms, surgery happens within 24 to 48 hours, but his imaging came back and more bad news arrived. He had small tumors on his other kidney, which happens in only about 35 to 45 kids every year in America. And it meant things got a lot more complicated because a child can live with one kidney, but not with zero kidneys. An immediate goal is that we wanted to prioritize Owen's emotional well-being. His innocence was being stripped away with every test, and we didn't know how to respond. We'd promised our kids a trip to Disneyland later that year, and now what if it never happened? Something we learned the first time we went through cancer is how people show up in all kinds of unique ways during a crisis. We don't always know what to do for others during grief, and I know I've gotten it wrong at times, but the kindness of this church community and many of you in this room is that you did so much right for us. I won't even attempt to tell you all the ways that friends and strangers came alongside us, but it was incredibly, incredibly humbling. It started with Disneyland and some friends paying for us to go for 2 days with strict orders from Owen's oncologist to avoid a lot of the fast, jerky rides. We might have been the saddest people there, but we made a memory with our children that felt important at the time. Our home group, while we were away, came into our new house and they created a fake shiplapped fireplace for us so that we could have a gathering place of warmth and comfort in the months to come. These were equally some of the best gifts we've ever received and ever will receive in our whole life. And then there was the gift of our church leadership. The elder board wanted to lay hands on us one evening during their Monday night meeting, and so we came, raw and worn out. I remember telling them I was afraid I could lose my faith in this, and instead of lecturing or telling us that wouldn't happen, I just remember Mike Wilbanks beginning to sing, "Christ Will Hold Me Fast." A few weeks after that, we went over to Steve and Donna Jolly's house. And I remember Steve saying that we may not feel like talking to God much right now, but to stay in the Psalms. Lament is what he encouraged us to do. He said, just park yourself in the Psalms and stay there. Pastor and writer A.J. Svoboda says, the authors of the Psalms praise and worship and glorify God, but not just after their troubles have passed. Rather, they seem to find a way to weave praise and worship in the middle of their troubles and tribulation. Old Testament scholars call this anticipatory praise. I found that during this time of great grief, my soul actually really longed to worship, which is interesting because I was quite angry at God. There were moments that the anger was so deep and so raw that I used very, very unacceptable language when I addressed him. But looking back, what matters is that I kept addressing him. After our quick Disneyland trip, Owen went in for his first surgery where they placed a port in his chest and he immediately started chemotherapy that day. This photo of Owen just kills me because he's smiling, but all I remember from that day is crying. And, you know, going through pictures for this slideshow was so painful because a lot of them made me cry. I'm showing you some of the tough stuff, but there's a lot that was way too painful to show you. We decided we wanted to document all of it for him, believing that someday he'd want to see it and hear this story too. And we began praying his life verse over him, one that we'd chosen many years before. May the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace as you trust in him, so that by the power of the Holy Spirit, you may abound in hope. Romans 15:13. We asked as many people as we knew to pray this verse of joy, peace, and hope over him and our family. Another verse that was imparted upon me by two people was Exodus 14:14. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. After the year I'd just gone through where I felt God impressing me to be still, I took this verse as a restful gift. It was decided that because his tumor was so big and because he had tumors on the other kidney, that he would begin first with 6 weeks of chemo to hopefully make the tumor removal easier. Chemotherapy was brutal, and he began losing his hair within a week. But we also noticed a marked change in his stomach. His tumor shrunk so much in the first week that I could feel a difference when I placed my hands on him. And because of his huge response, the doctors decided to continue with 6 more weeks of chemo to see if everything would shrink even more. We used this 12-week time span to interview surgeons across the country and research best options for him. One of the harder days we had at the beginning of his treatment was when our oldest daughter, Anna, became sick with a really bad viral infection. Anna has asthma, but at the time we thought she'd outgrown it. And so because we were so distracted by Owen, we didn't pay close enough attention to how she was handling her infection. All of us were home one Friday in November. Owen was sleeping off his chemo and Anna was also napping. And when she woke up, her lungs and her throat were so impacted by the asthma that had crept up that she was struggling to even talk. I remember thinking I needed to get her into the emergency room within the hour, and then realized about a minute later she was struggling to breathe and I needed emergency help now. And so I called 911. And for days after that, we walked around shaky because life felt so fragile on so many levels. When we thought we couldn't take anything else, it felt like there was more. On January 31st, we went down to UCLA where we left Owen in the hands of his surgeons at 7 a.m. and we didn't see him again until 8 p.m. The Lamuts got us a hotel room near the hospital to use as a home base, and a friend of ours, a pediatric specialist at a hospital in Texas, came down to help. I had never experienced a surgery like this where you sit with strangers for so many hours, your stomach in knots. A song that was very new at the time and meant a lot to me that day was Raise a Hallelujah, and I listened to it in my ears as we paced around the outdoor patio at UCLA. Here, in the middle of the terrible and the unbelief, my weapon was praise. And the reason I could praise God is because even if my son didn't survive surgery or didn't survive this disease, I knew that death wasn't going to have the final say in his life or mine. I had to go back to the basics of my faith, remembering that death was never, ever part of God's original design. God's plan and the gift of his son Jesus is a kingdom that exists forever where suffering is finished and all is well. But in addition to what he's promised someday, his other gift to us is that he is present with us now. I was not alone in my suffering. Owen was not alone on the operating table. Jesus is not a promise for later, but a presence for today. And when I sing to him, I experience that presence. It was my greatest hope. We were finally able to see Owen later that night. The surgery hadn't gone as well as they hoped. His necrotic tumor was everywhere in his abdomen, touching many major organs. And his other kidney with the small tumors had precancerous material everywhere. His surgeon was apologetic. I remember her saying, "I did the best I could, but he's going to need more chemotherapy and radiation." We ran up to his room in the pediatric ICU and we just wept. He was just waking up. He was covered in tubes coming out of his nose and stomach, IVs everywhere. He was totally naked. His weak, bald body just about did me in. And I remember Jonathan and I laying at the foot of his bed while his eyes fluttered open and shut, singing hymns to him. It rained that entire night. It was pouring rain, mixed with the sound of trauma helicopters landing just above us as we tried to sleep, but we couldn't. And the days in the hospital after that were just horrible. Owen was in a lot of pain and very weak, and we were really worn out. One morning, our pastor, Benji, drove down from Santa Barbara and he brought us breakfast and a scripture reading. And I remember he was so funny because he looked up a restaurant on Yelp to bring us food. And when he got to the restaurant, it was located inside a gas station. And he showed up and said, "Well, I brought you gas station food." It was really funny and one of many small mercies throughout our time at UCLA when so much was still unknown. But after a week, he came home. He was home and he'd started a few weeks of radiation at the cancer center downtown and started several more months of chemotherapy. This picture on the screen of him, I took on the first day of Lent when he was starting radiation, and the little cross on his abdomen above his scars reminded me of the ash crosses on the foreheads that day. These months were terrible and horrible and beautiful all at the same time. Life was very simple. It now reminds me of the early days of the pandemic when everything was fragile, but we were with the people we loved. I lit candles nightly. We had dance parties. Some mornings there was a lot of throwing up and crying, but then it would pass and we'd play video games or bake. Owen had days where he biked and played t-ball and seemed like any other five-year-old. And then there were days where his bald head and pale face would make me weep at night. This is a picture of his oncologist, Dr. Shivani, letting him play video games while she examined him. We were in the doctor's office at least once, if not several times every week. In early June of 2019, on the day his classmates graduated preschool, he rang a different bell, the one marking the end of treatment. We wore yellow ribbons and we let him run through a huge banner and we cried our eyes out because he'd done 7 months of treatment, the same as his dad, with some of the same drugs from October to June, and somehow they'd both beaten it. And here's a little post-cancer celebration on the screen. Disney World on better terms. On this trip, his wish trip, Owen got to meet another little boy the same age who'd gone through treatment for the same cancer at the same time. And we still keep in touch with his family. I think that's God's mercy right there. The most wonderful part of finishing cancer treatment is that cancer treatment is done. But what a lot of people don't talk about is how terrifying it can be. For Owen, he's been followed with testing every 3 months since then. And every 3 months, we've gone in for blood work, a CT scan, an ultrasound, or an X-ray. Sometimes a combination, usually, of those four things. And each time, we learn again how to place him in the arms of a God who loves him more than we do. And along the way, we continue to celebrate, and we also continue to grieve. I tell God how thankful I am over and over and over again. And I also tell God I'm sad. I am sad he has side effects from his treatment. I'm sad at what his treatment will mean for his future health. And I am nervous every single time he gets a stomach ache. But I tell God these things. I'm not afraid anymore to be afraid. When Owen first got his diagnosis, I really struggled with the charge, do not fear or do not be afraid. Because if you regularly read the Bible, you'll know that do not fear is everywhere. It was quite common in those early months that well-meaning friends or family would remind me that I had no reason to be afraid. And I really didn't know what to do with that. Because how was I supposed to not be afraid for my child? It was one of several questions I had to wrestle with when it came to faith. And what I slowly became to realize is that when I heard God's voice originally projected, it sounded like, do not fear. When really, God's voice is a lot softer and kinder and more loving than that. What it actually sounds like is how I speak to Owen, or really to any of my children. Hey, I know you're afraid. This is really scary. You've never had to do a test like this before, and you don't know what to expect. I'm so sorry that you're scared. I wish I could do this for you, because you're right, this is hard. But I'm right here. I'm holding your hand, and I love you, and I believe in you. We are in this together. Being able to hear God's voice in the tone it actually sounds like is faith transforming, because no one wants to talk to someone who is angry and lacks patience and tells us to shape up. But that's not God. God is actually eager to listen, incredibly understanding, and ready to offer comfort. And after so many months of yelling at him and realizing that he didn't yell back, it allowed me to start just crying with him instead. And for many, many months after treatment ended, I cried often, because God is comfortable with my emotion and he likes me to tell him about it. I realized after cancer treatment that I wasn't sure how to go back to normal life again. I'd had this weird pre-cancer life where I'd quit all the things, and then the cancer year where everything centered around helping Owen survive and thrive. And so now what? I found that I wasn't ready to go back to a fast-paced life again. And as we flubbed our way around in trying to figure out what post-cancer life should look like, we entered a global pandemic where we went right back to staying home and being cozy and homeschooling again. So I suppose that a gift of learning how to be not in control is that you can stop grasping for as much control and you can start being less rattled with the things that used to rattle us. And that's where I'm at now in my own career and my striving, learning slowly how to pay attention to what God's doing in my life, how he wants to use me, and joining him in that adventure without the need to strive for it a certain way. A few months ago, Owen celebrated 3 months of off treatment, and his dad marked 10 off treatment. He also graduated to only twice yearly follow-up instead of quarterly. And so when you see him running around here, I'm sure you'd never guess how sick he once was. He's also a really delightful and well-adjusted 9-year-old. And when I think back to the prayers we prayed over him nightly during treatment, I get glimpses of those prayers for hope, joy, and peace being answered in him. And it's so beautiful. We will probably never know why Owen got cancer. It was likely formed in utero. And after a massive amount of genetic testing, there is no known link to Jonathan's cancer. There are all kinds of changes we've made to our lifestyle, home products, and diet over the last 10 years. Was it enough? Does it matter? I still refuse to lose sleep over those questions. I think about my 97-year-old grandparents who are still alive and have been exposed to so many of the same things that I've been exposed to. And it's not that I don't take care, but also I'm doing everything I can to not require questions or answers from God and to not control my life to an extent that I miss the point, which is this: I don't control my life and I won't always know what God is doing in mine or my children's lives. I won't ever know why God didn't answer my prayers for miraculous healing without chemotherapy. Sometimes I get really bummed he didn't do that for Owen. But God's method and way of healing looks different than what I expected. And I'm okay with the mystery of all of it because I'm confident he is for me and for Owen and cares deeply for his people. The summer after Owen finished treatment, Jonathan and I spent 3 intensive days with a counselor who helped us not only process some of the health crises that we've faced, but also address our emotional and spiritual life as a whole. And one of the days, as we spent time in prayer, I had a vision of myself on a stage with a huge audience watching me. I'm not sure what I was doing on stage or the specifics of the crowd, but what struck me is what happened when I finished. The counselor asked me where God was in the picture, and I looked over to the wings of the stage, and I saw a father figure, a huge smile on his face, clapping wildly. He was proud of me, and the look of pride mattered 100 times more than the clapping from the audience. We all search for significance in various ways. Some of us yearn for it even more than others. I find that I go through seasons where the desire to be seen and cheered for is quite high. I'll notice myself becoming jealous of others' success or attention, and I'll wonder why I haven't achieved more professionally. Sometimes I don't even need an affirmation of what I've accomplished, but an acknowledgement that I'm living through something hard. Last year, Owen had emergency complications from his major surgery, and we were back in the hospital. It required a very sudden procedure where a nasogastric tube was placed up his nose and down his throat for a couple of days. The pediatric surgeon hadn't even finished announcing the decision before his tiny room filled up with 4 other nurses ready to assist. It was a moment where everyone brings their very best to the table. Our eyes made intentional contact above our masked faces, and filled with adrenaline, I began giving orders because after you go through something hard with your kid, you know when to speak up and you know how to help your kid. And I wanted to give the medical team direction on how to best handle this very sensitive child who was gonna scream. And Owen needed me to help him through what was happening so that it could get done. In moments, we'd become a team and I'd appointed myself coach. And it was terrible, but Owen followed instructions and the tube was placed on the first try and we all breathed a huge sigh of relief. And soon the room cleared and the lights dimmed, and I collapsed on the chair in the room and took out my phone and texted Jonathan an update as we waited to be admitted to the upper stairs pediatric floor. Then one of the ER nurses quietly came back into the room. It was close to midnight, and he stood at the end of Owen's bed and crossed his arms just watching him sleep. And it was evident that he didn't have any medical reason for coming back into the room. "I looked at your son's medical file," he said, "and I just want you to know I'm so proud of him. I'm so proud of both of you. He's gone through a lot, and you both did a good job tonight." I've thought about that nurse's words since then. There's something about the phrase, "I'm proud of you," that felt so unusual coming from someone in a busy emergency department when hard things happen all the time. In a moment when my husband wasn't allowed to come in, someone else noticed the hard stuff and told me so, and I really needed someone to see it. I want to be the type of person who notices when others need affirmation. I've thought about how he was so specific in the words he chose to use, "I'm proud of you," and what that phrase felt like to receive. But even more than what it felt like to be seen by a stranger was the reminder that God sees me too in all the moments where others don't. Even though I mess up and make mistakes, God's grace for me is not situational. And a lot of times I forget that God not only sees me, but is also proud of me. That image of him clapping on the wings of the stage shouldn't feel surprising or unusual, but I continue to be struck by how my ears don't often hear his encouragement. When we belong to Jesus, he sees us in our hardest moments, and he is proud of us. There's probably many of you who aren't sure how God feels about you. And for some, we may think God doesn't even like us all that much, that he's checked out, worried about bigger things. Maybe you have a hard time hearing his voice, or you're unsure whether you can trust his character. And I just want to say that despite the pain we all carry through this world, God's character is loving and kind and good. And he invites us into a life of intimacy and interaction that doesn't cancel out deep pain, but gives us a way through it. I don't want to make any assumptions, but I have to imagine that after a couple really unsteady years, we all carry some grief and loss. Some of you, on top of a pandemic, have gone through huge life changes, your own illnesses, loss, longing, financial distress, and life pivots. Frederick Buechner is a great American writer, and sadly, he passed away just a few weeks ago. I'd like to end by reading you a quote from his work, Whistling in the Dark. I hope that in whatever grief you swim through in this life, you'll recognize God is there too. He's cheering you on. He doesn't want you to be afraid, but he also understands when you are. This is what he says. You never know what may cause tears. The sight of the Atlantic Ocean can do it, or a piece of music, or a face you've never seen before. A pair of somebody's old shoes can do it. Almost any movie made before the great sadness that came over the world after the Second World War. A horse cantering across a meadow. A high school basketball team running out onto the gym floor at the start of a game. You can never be sure. But of this, you can be sure. Whenever you find tears in your eyes, especially unexpected tears, it is well to pay the closest attention. They are not only telling you something about the secret of who you are, but more often than not, God is speaking to you through them of the mystery of where you have come from and is summoning you to where, if your soul is to be saved, you should go to next. Thank you.